Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of the Real Estate Investor's Playbook. I'm Andrew Schuster.
David Bond.
Andrew Johns.
And we're three real estate nerds, essentially, who play different roles in the real estate investing process. Myself serve as an investor and deal sponsor.
And I am a private hard money lender.
And I'm a real estate with almost two decades worth of experience helping people invest in real estate.
So this is the trifecta. This is effectively what it takes to get a deal done, but there's so many other people and parties involved in real estate investing. So I guess let's just take a step back and just so we can introduce ourselves to this audience. And this is our first episode. If you guys like it, hopefully we can keep doing this. So give us your feedback. We appreciate it. But you know, really, I guess, Andrew, if you can start off and just give us your background in real estate, how you got into this game.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, I grew up, my mother was a realtor, my father was a house flipper, acquired my first property, 21 years old. That was a really cool learning experience, flipped the house with my father. And then, we hired some realtors to sell these flip properties, and we realized we're spending a lot of money in commissions. So we decided to, allow me to get my license, and then the 2008, the market pivoted quite a bit during that era. So then I marketed to my friends and my family and really just grew my business from there.
How about you, David?
So I was in a completely different world. I was on the wholesale side of men's shoes for 20 years, and that was phenomenal, a lot of fun. Ironically, I followed my father, Steve, unintentionally throughout most of his career pivots, and I was on the road all the time, and the road's cool until the road's not cool. So I was about 8 years ago looking for a lifestyle change and trying to figure out what I was gonna do. My father was a one-man show, one-man shop in as a hard money lender. Started talking to him, and really interesting. There was a lot of synergy between what I was currently doing from a sales perspective and what he needed, was looking for, felt that I could, a role that he felt I could fill. So I shadowed him for about 6 months while I was doing my other gig, and decided to make the move in August of 2017. And so here I am.
Right on. Fast forward to 2025, and the market's shifted quite a bit in the last days, let alone weeks, months, and years before. So there's so many things we could talk about in terms of how everything affects real estate, but at a basic level, you need money to buy real estate, right? And so for me, as a kind of rookie investor, I mean, I started in this game like a little over a year ago, and obviously have learned a lot since and have done quite a few projects since. But I think a lot of people are reluctant to jump in because they don't think they can, and they think they don't have the means to do so. But having worked with Trias and hard money lending, now I can understand the value of putting money down and bringing money to the table. And obviously there's a lot of ways to do that. We can talk about the private investment side, but I guess if somebody wanted to flip a house, theoretically, if somebody out there is a first time investor, like from your guys' perspective, like what's the first step? Do they talk to the lender? Do they find the house first with Andrew? How does the process work in the best case scenario from your guys' perspectives?
I'll jump in. I think it really boils down to mindset. One of my favorite quotes from Henry Ford, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're probably right. So, making sure you have the right investor on board, linking up with the right partnership, right? There's tons of realtors, there's tons of hard money lenders out there, but getting connected with someone that actually knows what they're doing and it can walk you through those ropes. And, there has to be an immense level of confidence to dive into this, because there's always the one and done theory. You grab a flip and they do it and it doesn't work out well, and then you don't grow, right? So you have to do this over and over again to take it to the next level. And that's what I've learned, is that experience really does matter when you are investing.
So do they come, if somebody says I want to flip a house, should they call an agent first? Should they call a lender first? What do you think? Should you research? What is that first step when somebody's like, I've got this, I think I can do this?
So I think that, it's different for everybody, right? Approach, I've found in this world that approach really varies. So once you decide that you're going to do it, it's it's about putting your team together, right? And how you see those steps unfolding is completely up to you. It's your perspective. But I am, and I may be a little subjective with this, but I think it's really important to find the source of your money first, right? And then you can find a property. But you want to know where the money's coming from. And, you know, the big piece of that as a lender is it's about scale and leverage, right? There are plenty of folks out there that can, that have enough money on their own to be able to do that first flip themselves with their own funds, right? That being said, if you're coming out of pocket with 100% of the financing, of the funding, and you're self-funding, that not only limits your ability to A, find another property, but what about life unfolding and all the things that are unforeseen? You know, it can be your hot water heater. It can be, God forbid, you know, something that is tragic, or an accident, or, you know, you have a storm, or you have a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And the landscape completely shifts and you've got all of your money in this first property for yourself, right? So finding funding, securing funding, finding out how fundable you are is, from my perspective, really important as a first step. And then it's about finding, okay, so you've got to find a property to be able to make the move now, right? And then once you do that, if it needs rehab, who are you going to get to do the renovation, right? Now you've got to find the contractor. So it's really about building your team, and it's up to you how you put those steps together and what's most important to you. In a perfect world, you're kind of doing them 1, 2, 3, you know, and doing them together. And once you find your team, then you build the relationship, then you build the trust, then it starts to flow. And, you know, fortunately, we're a really good example of that, you know, the three of us. So, and I think that you can probably shed some really unique perspective on how you approached it, because you did this exact same thing a little over a year ago.
Yeah, no, totally. It's cool to hear both your perspectives on it. And I think there's really no bad place to start, even speaking to an attorney, whoever it is. Getting feedback and guidance has been the biggest driver for me personally. I don't know what I don't know, and I asked questions to people who I respected, who I knew had experience. Met both of you kind of more organically. I'll talk about real estate tricks and how to get listings from a customer perspective. Andrew showed up at my first flip that I was doing a for sale by owner at the time. In a beautiful, great location, and I've done some things well and some things that definitely I learned from. But Andrew was like, I got somebody who's interested in this house, I'm gonna take a look. I'm still not sure if I believe him or not. And I do trust this guy entirely, but I think that might be a tactic to get great listings. But ultimately ended up not listing with Andrew and ended up having to sell that house. But we then synced up again, and we've been off to the races ever since. You can't do it yourself. So I'd say my journey has very much been about asking questions, asking early and often. I mean, I met with your dad over at Trias maybe 6 months before I did my first flip, with the notion of trying to do a commercial development project. And that's a whole separate can of worms. We're talking mostly residential on this, but I got real honest feedback, and not all of it was good.
From my dad?
From every guy. Never. No, shout out to Steve Bond and Josh and your whole team over at Trias. You guys have been not only a great financial partner, but great mentors. And as my agent, Andrew, you've become a really close friend of mine, as a sounding board and a trusted partner. It's more than just these transactional relationships. So, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes, but I've fixed them quickly. And I think that's what I've learned in business, but let alone in the real estate business in the last year. So asking those questions and then finding kind of my purpose, right? I didn't know what I didn't know then, and I know a lot more now, but there's so much to talk about and learn about in real estate. And for me, it's become a real hobby. It's a passion of mine. I really enjoy this game. It's and it is a game. And I think calling this a playbook and helping people out there understand and demystify some of the complexities around it is what I hope we can do with this. But ultimately, just asking people and being really honest with myself about what I could and couldn't do. And that ultimately has led me to what, our seventh project now in like 12 months. I mean, it's been really incredible, but kind of put our trust into our team and to the market and hope for the best. But if you mitigate risk and you ask the right questions, I think people can win in this game.
And you had one of the purest axioms that I've heard in a really long time. And last time we were together, you said it, and it's so true. Is you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together. Right.
Absolutely.
And that is the overriding principle to this game, in my opinion. Right. Like, you have got to. It always comes back to team. Right. And you've mentioned it a couple of times already. You don't know what you don't know. So it's a constant learning process. And, you know, I think one of the key roadblocks to any new real estate investor is paralysis by analysis. Right. It hits a point where if this is something that you're passionate about and that you really want to do, and you pull the trigger. You know, they're not all going to be home runs. And matter of fact, early on, I heard a guy who had done this for years. I was at a meetup and, you know, I was brand new to this and I was learning a ton myself. And he said something that's always stuck with me. And he was speaking to a really large group of people. And he said, the worst thing that ever happened to me was I hit a home run on my very first deal, right? And I expected everything after that to look like the first one did. And I didn't realize till I was 7, 8, 9 deep that that first one was a unicorn jumping over a rainbow, you know? And it looks like that, you know? So it's it always comes down to ROI, but ROI is very relative, right? And I think that people oftentimes forget or don't take into account the value of the learning process in going through anyone, because nothing goes super smooth, nothing goes according to plan in this world. But again, to your point, it's about mitigating risk, making the best decisions that you can with the information that you have, and surrounding yourself with people that you trust that give you the feedback that you need to move forward in as smooth and easy a way as possible.
And if you buy right, and if you buy a property at the right price, you can mitigate a lot of risk. So I guess let's look at the market today as it stands, but let alone in general, forget interest rates. Like, what is an acquisition framework for a real estate investor, particularly on the fix and flip side?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you definitely have to be passionate about this, right? You have to want to jump into real estate to, you know, for the long game. I mean, you can make a couple bucks here and there, but the long game is where it's at, where you can really make this very successful, right? What we pay attention to is the micro, right? What's happening in that particular zip code, and also the macro level, what's happening in the world, right? Not paying attention to rates and things like that, wars and what have you. But, you know, boiling down, you know, the right property, there's a lot that goes into it. We want to search, you know, what's happening in the neighborhood. Is this neighborhood, you know, declining, or is it, you know, plateauing, or what's going on there? What we really look for is really unique properties that have an upswing of big numbers, right? If you buy a property that the whole entire neighborhood has, right, the whole neighborhood selling between 5 and 6, that's pretty much what you're going to get. But if you pick a pocket of town that's going to have ranging from 600,000 to 1.2, you can flare up those numbers. So getting your I've always learned, you know, you make your money when you buy. You buy too high, you're not going to have your swing of your profit to be where it's got to be, right? So there's a lot of factors that go into figuring out what's a good property, what's not. And one of the things that's really stuck with me, are you a hunter or are you a farmer? I go out in the morning and I hunt, right? I want to make sure, also I hunt at night too. I want to make sure I could find the right deals, you know. So when I go
out, night vision goggles.
Yeah, right. When I want to make sure I could find the right deals. Like, sometimes I'll sift for 30 minutes and pick a couple up, and sometimes I'll sift for 3 hours and won't pick anything up. It really just depends on where the market is right now. So did a lot of searching last night. Wasn't really anything that great to look at. I mean, I think there's always deals when you get the house for the right price, but you really got to look to find that deal. And what I look for is, like I said earlier, finding the right house in the right pocket.
What do you guys find the first-time investor average deal sizes? And for context, anybody who's outside of Baltimore, we're located in Baltimore, Maryland, in between Baltimore City and Baltimore County. When you see folks come to the table from that perspective, are they looking for townhouses? Are they looking for single-family luxury flips? Like, do they always make the right decisions? Are you ever trying to guide them to the right place? Or is it like any house to get in the game if the deal structure is right is a good deal.
Yeah, I find that most people search between the 250 to 350 acquisition pocket right now in today's world. I mean, reverse back 5-10 years ago, 150, 200 was a good swing.
And this is fix and flip. And we'll talk about buy and flip separately, but
yeah,
for this part.
This is fix and flip. Yeah. So 250 to 350 is kind of that sweet pocket now, just because of, you know, the average home price here in Baltimore is around 450. So you gotta buy in there probably 250-350 for the, you know, the first time investor. At least that's what
city,
I'm saying.
City, county, or is it irrelevant?
City, you probably get a little bit lesser of a, you know, acquisition price. But county, you know, we find more people buying single families. There are plenty of investors in the city.
Primarily detached or primarily row homes?
Detached.
Yeah. Are you seeing that as well?
So it's the landscape for us has changed pretty dramatically over the course of the last 7 years. When I first started, it was eyes on, boots on. We were seeing every property before we agreed to fund it. As we've grown, not only have we expanded our regionality and where we're willing to fund. So it used to be Maryland with a significant focus on Baltimore and Baltimore City. And a lot of lenders, Baltimore City is a really unique animal. So a lot of lenders wouldn't fund in Baltimore City, particularly national lenders.
It's the nicest thing anybody's ever said about Baltimore, by the way. Thank you.
You know, I always try and frame it positive. You know, I love this city. I love everything about it. And I'm a homer from that perspective. I'm not blind to some of the challenges that it presents, but find me a city that doesn't, right? And at the end of the day, you hit on the number one rule, and you know, it's really 101. It is top of the list, far and away, is you make all your money on the buy, right? That's what gives you the margin that you need for your rehab, right? And I've never heard under budget and ahead of schedule, right? It doesn't happen. So you need that buffer. You want a 5 to 10% buffer. And, you know, you want to approach things conservatively. And on the ARV, you know, again, approach it conservatively. So when I get a range on, and I'll always run numbers for my borrowers, right? When I get a range on the rehab and it's gonna be between 70 and 85, I'm always running the numbers at 85, right? And then the ARV is gonna be somewhere between, let's say, 250 and 275. Then I'm running the numbers with, you know, 250, right? So we're always looking at worst case scenario, if you will, or the most conservative approach. And that way, if we're ready to move forward with that deal at that point, ideally the only, you know, the numbers should only get better, you know? So that's always the approach that that we take on our side, because we want to put our borrowers in the best position to succeed. Because, you know, as you mentioned early on, if you fail on that first one, not only, you know, does that at the very least put a stall on your real estate investment career, but you're also going to remember the person or the lender that said, yeah, we'll fund that deal, and you're not coming back to that lender, right? So always put your borrowers in the best possible position and share all the information that you have. But, you know, I think that, you know, to your question, it's where we're willing to fund, what we're willing to fund, has grown and evolved. And so we used to have a $100,000 minimum in terms of loan amount. So that 80% of your purchase coupled with the 100% of your rehab needed to be 100 or above. And that fit really well for Baltimore City. But Baltimore City is only part of our niche anymore, and a much smaller part than it was originally. So we've increased our minimum to 150. Right? And it keeps our borrowers in a really good place. It keeps us in a really good place. It keeps our investors in a really good place, and sets everybody up for success. So, you know, I think that's one of the main points of real estate investing, is it's constantly evolving, as both of you know.
Totally. But if you buy right and you do your math properly, I think you can win no matter what. And of course, you got to look at the absolute low side and reverse engineer for what the comp is, but if you buy in certain areas, there is pretty incredible growth potential. So we'll talk about renovation and finishes and appraisal in a second, but at a practical level today, what is the date? January 21st, 2025, what does someone need to come to the table with to be qualified, to get a hard money loan, to go buy a house? And then a second part of that, how much extra money should they factor into their budget for the loan costs, well before rehab, but like realistically, how much money and what qualifications does someone need to get into the game for the kind of houses we're talking about?
So the way we approach it is we need our borrower to have skin in the game, right? The last thing we ever want to do is have to take back a property and finish it and complete it and sell it ourselves, right? Or make it part of our portfolio. So that's never the goal. That's the solution if things go sideways, right? So we want to avoid that at all costs. So the skin in the game, from our perspective, our comfort level, and it shifts and it improves as we grow the relationship with our borrower, and you're a perfect example of that. But it generally starts at between 15 or 20% of the purchase price, and we'll fund the other 80 to 85% of the purchase and 100% of the rehab, right? Now, something to consider there, which I'm always very upfront about with my borrowers, is we do not give that rehab money in advance of the work being done, right? So if you've got, let's say, a $100,000 rehab, we don't give you $10,000, $25,000, or $100,000 once we close.
Which, right? I did not know until after we signed the contract and our project already started. I knew, I didn't read the fine print, and I should have, but it's common in hard money lending. A draw system makes sense, but in retrospect, I didn't know. So luckily, we've got some credit cards together, and it funded a couple nights of our honeymoon. So with the points. So thank you for that. But no, you got to really, you got to think through these things and budget accordingly. Closing costs down the line, commissions, right? Like, it adds up, right? Yeah. So even if you buy right and you don't factor in those costs, you could get burned pretty badly. And obviously, having a good relationship with everyone and being able to work through problems, it makes it a lot easier. And I'm sure most cases do. But yeah, I just think from a practical level, like, somebody's got maybe $50,000 to work with, all in. Can they, and you know, okay credit, not great credit, but okay. Like, can they get in the game, or do they need more than that? From your perspective,
they can with 50, they can definitely get in the game, right? So you want to factor in, obviously. Okay, so if I need to give my contractor X amount to start, I need to have that on the side too, right? Whenever we run numbers, we factor in closing costs. And closing costs are going to be, generally speaking, all closing costs, inclusive of lender points, right, and third-party costs. It's going to be roughly 8%, give or take. And again, we try to factor that in conservatively as well. But you also have to factor in the closing costs on the back end, right? And that's going to wind up being in the neighborhood of 7%. So again, whenever I'm running numbers, I try to be as transparent as possible about it, what it looks like on the front and what it looks like on the back. And I can't tell you how many times that when I tell people what they can expect to make from a net return, like, wait, what? How does that work? But when I walk them through the numbers, because it's a business, right? So your percent down of the purchase, right? Your closing costs, your monthly interest payments, because if it's $150,000 for that loan, right, that's what we're lending you, you're paying interest on a monthly basis on that loan amount, right? So when you get to the end, there's a big difference between your gross profit and your net profit, because you, as a business, you're paying yourself back what it cost you to do this deal, right? And whenever I walk them through that, now they understand. Like, okay, I
know. It super confused me at first, and I thought there was some magic formula. I was missing something. How much percent should I put down? Is 38% the magic number? Is 20? There really is no magic number there. It's just whatever equity you can get in the deal is going to get you the biggest return possible if you pad it properly. Great to hear.
Yeah, and I would say you got to know your numbers. You got to run enough numbers to understand, is this a good play or not? And I always say, if it doesn't have the net profit of 50K or more in profit, it's probably not the best move, because 50K, you have to do a price improvement on the property, change the price from 350 to 335 or whatever the number may be, there goes 10, 15K, right? And then let's say the market softens, we have a pandemic or something happens, or you know, what have you, then you got to reduce it again. So your profit really starts to dwindle, right? So if I always say, if it doesn't have at least $50,000 in net profit or more, it's probably not a good property to act on. And there's a lot of different things to keep in mind too, right? Is the market, you know, declining, or is the market appreciating? You know, who's the president right now? What's going on? I mean, we just had a president change yesterday, right? So it's quite interesting time. So you got to really pay attention to a lot of different things. And, you know, experience does matter, like I said earlier. So if you haven't walked this road before, you would d- definitely recommend tiptoeing into it, making sure you're making the right moves, because if you don't have a good pioneer that's done this before, it could be a really rocky start, and it could put you out of production moving forward.
Do most of your real estate investor clients use hard money, or are there different types of financing people are using?
Yeah, most of them use hard money. I'd say nearly 100%. I have very few that just take cash on, right? Most of them are definitely using hard money. Now, obviously, there's also buy and hold as well, and they're using different types of products rather than hard money. But hard money for flips is what we're predominantly using.
Interesting. So somebody's got the financing relationship set. They know they have the money. They found a great property. Contractor renovation. Let's talk about that. I think a lot of people have this misconception that all flippers just go in and just like HGTV, builder grade, knock a wall down. And from a guy who picks out every single piece of hardware, fixture, appliance for the flips we do, you know, these little details matter so much, not just from a design perspective, but from an appraisal perspective. And just to give an anecdote here, the first flip I did, added a bathroom and a bedroom in the basement. I did not realize, because I was trying to sell this house myself and didn't call Andrew earlier, I didn't realize that did not appraise the same as above ground. So above ground square footage, not the same as below. So things like that are things you wouldn't know until you get deep into it. But of course, there's that's why you work with an agent, right? So in retrospect, but frankly, the learning for me was so good that, you know, the medicine was so good, if you will, because I like making my own mistakes so I can fix them and I know what to do. But assuming somebody doesn't make that same mistake, and hopefully if you're listening, absolutely work with an agent early and often, pay the commission, you'll be happy you did, you'll sell the house for more, and they'll give you great feedback. But how much does renovation play a role in appraisal? How much oversight do you as a lender want there? How much input do you give or want to give? How much does the neighborhood play a role into the aesthetic? Really, at the end of the day, my question is, what's going to drive the most appraisal when you're doing the renovation?
So this is my favorite part of flipping houses. Like, it's, you can analyze a property online, but you're not actually at the property. Once you tour the property, we use a lot of our senses. We don't just use our eyes. We use our nose. Do we smell anything weird? We use our ears. Do we, you know, hear any noise pollution, things like that. And sometimes we go to a property, there's a cell phone tower nearby. That's probably going to be a deterrent, hurt the value of the property most likely, right? So once we're at the property, we analyze it. You know, can we take down walls? The design process really, really does matter. You know, where can we add a pantry? Can we add any hidden nooks? I always say, if you're going to be like everybody else, you're going to get pricing like everybody else. So you really, really have to put your eyes on the property, and you have to have experience to what you can do, what you can change in a property to make it a really cool design, right? I spend a lot of time with energy, feng shui. You know, is there a lot of, you know, natural light in the property?
Namaste.
Yeah, right? is it a feel-good property, right? Is there good parking for entertainment? You know, is there a spot where you can have people over for Thanksgiving? There's lots of room to sit, right? People, when you walk in the property, you got to get a sense of, would you be a buyer that buys this property? And if you're not, you're probably not going to have the best ARV, right? So we really want to push that ARV by putting, you know, good quality finishes in the property. If, like I said earlier, if you're like everybody else, you're going to get like everybody else pricing. So if you use the same paint colors, yeah, you know, use the same flooring like everybody else, you don't make those changes that you thought you should have changed, then you're really going to hurt yourself, right? So I think that's where we pride ourselves. We've gone through a lot of different properties, and I think that's the power play that you and I have. We go through these properties eight to nine times a week.
And we like it.
Yeah. Yeah, we enjoy it. We enjoy it.
Yeah. You got to love it. You know, the design part, I didn't realize how much I do enjoy it. But, you know, it's interesting because I think you can – it depends on the property, too, in a lot of ways, right? I used to tell people that, you know, I come from a rock and roll background, and I was a drummer and then a frontman at one point, and I really look at the renovation process and really the whole deal cycle from acquisition to online, but I look at it as an audience, and how do I reverse engineer what the audience wants? So really try to study the neighborhood, the demographics, and, you know, I was really fortunate. This past year was on my honeymoon in Japan, and was looking for design inspiration the whole time, to my wife's annoyance, I'm sure. I was like, oh, look at that house. But we had a house in a neighborhood that really had some similar Japandi, which is a design term I didn't know until now, but Japandi kind of vibes and Asian vibes, and we were able to bring some of that into the actual aesthetic of a house and bring a really great product to market. But in some cases, builder grade is like completely what it needs. It doesn't need all the bells and whistles, but in other cases, particularly on like higher end flips, you know, the heated Japanese toilet matters, the island matters, the cabinetry matters, every detail matters. But if somebody's coming to the table and looking to buy like a lower income neighborhood, you know, builder grade on its own maybe will sell the house, but if you add crown molding, if you add a little bit of color, if you add a little bit of aesthetic to improve it, I think it can go a long way. So it's not necessarily about, like, in my view, spending a lot of money on your renovation. It's about picking the right things. But do you guys, as the lender, do you want to see that? Do you want to see the design? Do you want to see, you know, obviously the budget's there and you kind of give some discretion, I'm sure. But, like, are there things you guys know will, on both sides, on the lender and on the agents, are there things you know definitively will across the board increase appraisal of the house?
Well, to your point, I know the property, know the neighborhood, know your end buyer, right? Like, yep. Again, reverse engineer, but do that on the front side, right? So you know exactly what you're looking to do. And if I do this, I will accomplish my goal, or in a very close proximity to where I want to be, right? Barring anything completely unforeseen. That being said, I think that one of the upsides to approaching it this way is I'm the money, right? I'm here to help you accomplish your goals. Everything else, I'm happy to give you my opinion, I'm happy to give you my input, but it's your choice. The contractor is your choice. How you choose to approach the renovation is your choice. I'll be the first one to tell you that, and we all know that the renovation directly holds hands with the ARV. Right? So you want top of the market ARV, top of the market resale, you've got to do a top of the line rehab, period. Right? And that's going to change. It does and it doesn't, but you know, it's very different in a Baltimore City row home than in a $650,000 purchase that is kind of the pool that you've been swimming in, right? Looking to get that ARV of, you know, high six figures or, you know, over $1 million, right? So that customer is going to be looking for things that the Baltimore City row home bar or buyer is not looking for, right? So you approach it with the same set of eyes, but with a different perspective. And at the end of the day, the biggest challenge always, always is, who's my contractor? What's their work look like? Do they do what they say they're gonna do? Do they do it in a timely fashion? Are they using my money, because it is your money, right? Whether we're giving it to you or not, are they using my money to work on my property, right? And contractors are like all of us, right? You've got really good ones and you've got ones that aren't nearly as good, right? And I don't mean
that. And you have some actually bad ones who take people for rides intentionally.
For sure. And
but people find out pretty quickly.
We've seen that a number of times, which is why we do the draw process the way we do it, right? Like, I'm not trying to front you $15,000 to give to your contractors, so, you
and
know.
And he never came back.
Or go to AC for the weekend, right. You know? Yeah. And so there's lots of different challenges in there.
You guys have both heard nightmares and crazy stories about that kind of stuff.
I mean, I've had investors that say, you know, I'm doing three renovations at once. I got this incredible tile on discount, and I look at it, and it's pink. And they put it in the kitchen and the bathroom, right? And they put it in their next flip and their next flip, and it's just not even trending, right? So it's great you got a discount, but, like, the finishes really do matter. And, you know, don't be afraid to speak up. Like, if something's not to your liking, speak up about it. Like, it matters the way that the moldings are caulked. It matters the way that doors are shut, right? It matters the way that faucets turn on. And, you know, I go through the properties. I flush the toilets. I run the faucets. I listen to things, you know. And if something's wrong, I go through the contractor. Like, I have to sell this property. And honestly, like, my reputation is that line. And if I can't sell it property in the, you know, the first couple weeks, I'm working my ass off to move it because the contractor, you know, didn't do that great of a job, which is then going to hurt me to then sell it, which then there's a disbelief of my investor. Is it the realtor? Is the contractor, right? So, if you're up front with your investor, you're up front with your contractor, right then and there, you're going to hit the ground running moving forward. My father always told me, you know, if you don't do it right the first time, don't do it at all, right? So you got to do it right. And if you don't do it right, it's going to hurt you on the back end, which is then going to discourage you about jumping into your second, third, fourth flip.
For sure.
100%. And there's no right way to do the wrong thing, right?
You like, gotta make mistakes.
Yeah.
You gotta
yeah.
make them, yeah.
Yeah.
It's painful. I mean, this is a painful game. Once you're in it, you understand the mechanics, you can start,
yeah.
you can start being a little more comfortable, but you can't ever take your foot off the gas, and like you have to go to the property. You can't just hire, even if you're great, you have a great contractor, you cannot just hire them and, you know, submit the loan, submit the draw, and
yeah.
get the money. You gotta go and look at every single detail, and if you love it and you really care about the project and you care about the property, it's going to show. If you don't, it's going to show. So from a project management and kind of deal sponsor perspective, I can say that the details really do matter, and you really can't trust anyone. It's not because anybody's a bad person per se. It's because you have to be able to really control as much of the process as possible, because there's so many unknown factors, and we'll get into resale and interest rates and, you know, market saturation in a moment, but
and the onus yeah. is on you to be invested and involved, right?
Yeah.
Like it's once you've closed on that property, ideally your rehab is starting right away, right? And your contractor should become your best friend or your least favorite aunt, right? Either way, you're calling them all the time, right? One because you want to, one because you need to, and oftentimes it's the same thing, right? But that's your property, right? The onus is on you to make sure that they're doing it in the time frame that they laid out, right? And it's not always going to go exactly according to plan, but that scope of work and that draw schedule, which you have when you've started the property, we require that before we fund it, right? You should want to know what you're doing and how long it's going to take. We certainly want to know what you're doing and how long it's going to take. That's going to make that draw process super easy. So even if you have to come out of pocket, it's coming right back to you as soon as phase one is done, right? And then you're moving on to phase two. So if it were me on the buyer side, I am going to be calling my contractor every single day, and I'm going to be going by that property every second, every third day at the very least, just to make sure that everything that we discussed is actually being executed. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes is, okay, he's doing the work or she's doing the work. Are they? How
yeah.
do you know?
How's it look? And you know, like, we've come up with ideas that we hadn't had before just by virtue of checking on the work,
yeah.
and just make sure everything's good. And wow, what about that? And if you do it early, you can save a lot of headaches instead of, oh, this is already done, I gotta knock it all the way down.
100%.
And you pay three times the price it would have cost to do something the right way in the first place. But frankly, for me, I can't tell you what that house is going to be until that demo is done. I can't. And then once that's done, let the games begin. I mean, we're going to pick out cabinetry for a custom kitchen design after this. I can't wait because it's going to set the tone for the next phase. You know, the trades, the plumbing, all that stuff has to happen, of course. But knowing that we're going to have to buy some very expensive appliances for this particular property, it's a higher end flip, I had to budget for that. So I think we're going to have a whole other episode on just budgeting, project management, renovation, because there's so much talk about
yeah.
design trends. Maybe we'll get an interior designer on here or something to help give us some ideas. But I think we'll talk really quick about timeline from initial acquisition through renovation to resale, and we'll talk about exit strategy in a second, but from both of your perspectives, what is an average timeline, if done properly, from beginning to end, acquisition to resale?
I mean, they definitely range, right? I mean, you could have a flip you can do in a couple weeks. I mean, they're hard to find, right? And usually the profit margins aren't as high on a couple week in renovation flip, but I think the sweet spot is anywhere from 2 to 3 months. Right, you get a good acquisition, you know, the seller's aware, the public's aware, the buyer's aware, it needs a lot of work. But
2 to 3 months for the entire process from acquisition through closure, or just the
project? That's usually your renovation.
Just renovation, yeah.
Renovation, right. I mean, you could definitely find one in 4 to 6 weeks, but they're a little bit harder and usually don't have the upswing in the profit, right? So I usually find, you know, the biggest squeeze in profit would be the renovation being 2 to 3 weeks. Mm. And I always call it, I want to throw in there too, is we talk about power plays. What power plays can we add into this, you know, this renovation? And one of the biggest power plays that I know of, and we've done it many, many times, is we bring our contractor out there even before we close on the property, even before we're done our inspection negotiations, which I'm sure we'll talk about in later podcasts as well, is how we negotiate and what we do. But I think a really big power play is getting your contractor lined up, getting your numbers all in queue, but most importantly, scheduling your contractor and knowing what your phases are and journaling what you think that should look like. And then also, you know, delivering that message to the contractor, and then ordering key components that are going to be a little bit delayed. Let's say you have a roof shingle that's unique, or a siding that's unique, or a countertop that's going to be, you know, for that design. Getting ahead of that, because if, you know, you do your demo, you're like, let me get my cabinet guy in now, right? Let me get whoever in now, you know, whatever it may be, you're going to be 2-3 weeks delayed because of that material might be delayed. And now you got
to
wait
for a compromise on what you have to get and get the wrong design, which is going to affect your appraisal.
Exactly. So I think, you know, having your schedules, even before you sign, right, being ahead of that 2-3 weeks, I mean, you've already identified the property, you have your offer in, you have your inspections rolling, you get more of a forecast of the way things are going. But meanwhile, you're pushing that vision into your contract. Hopefully they get it. I'm sure they do if you've done multiple flips with them. But if you emphasize them, hey, man, I need you here, I need you now. And if you keep swinging the bat with them left and right, they're going to be by your side because it's repeat business.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and it's mind share as well, right? And once you have buy-in from your contractor, and particularly as you develop that relationship, you're sharing ideas, right? So there becomes a level of trust and a workflow and a continuity, right? And that is to the benefit of everybody involved. From a basic approach, you know, I've always, and I learned this early on from my father, and again, it leans on the conservative side, but conservative wins, right? Because I'd rather, from every perspective, underpromise and overdeliver, right? If you do better, you win, but we've planned accordingly, right? So that being said, and again, it'll vary based on the rehab, for sure, the size of the rehab, but I factor in and run numbers at 8 months, close to close, right? And I do that for a couple reasons. Again, I can't stress enough, under budget and ahead of schedule does not exist. If it does, great. Again, reference the unicorn that I spoke of earlier, right? It just doesn't happen, right? And there are things unforeseen. And
a little horn just came out of my head back here. So, yeah, I mean, we're trying to do that, but it is very difficult to do.
In a perfect world, you can, right? And in that world, then you win.
Yeah, when you over budget, you know that you're trying to go under budget, then certainly you can aim to do that. But even then, it's typically sound. It's typically, your 8 months is pretty exact, actually. I found, I was like, I'm going to beat that. It was 8 months to a day my first flip. Granted, I sold it myself, so I tried to, it was a little different, but
right,
I'm going to beat that. That's my goal.
and you know, and go ahead and bend that curve as you should, as you move to flip 2, flip 5, flip 10.
Well,
right?
I went until 12, but you know, it all evens out in the end, right? It's just not all the same, but typically you're right, it's about 8 months.
Yeah, and what buyers often don't factor in is, and that was, I was waiting to hear your answer to that question, the 2 to 3 months, and he said, yeah, for the rehab. And again, depending on the size of the rehab for sure, but that being said, okay, so now you finish the rehab, you gotta list it, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully it sells right away, right? If you got a rock star agent, hopefully it will. And, you know, that groundwork is already laid. But let's say it does. Let's say it sells in that first 1 to 2 weeks. You have multiple offers and you get your offer, right? That buyer now has to close through a conventional lender.
Yeah, let's
right?
all cash. You're waiting 30 days, 15 to 30 days minimum.
Yeah, and on the end buyer on a flip property, is not buying cash 99 out of 100
times.
We're
not Miami here.
Exactly. So living in the world that we live in, you know, and keeping everything in perspective, it's going to be now going through the conventional lending process another 45, maybe 60 days if everything goes smoothly for them to close. So that's 2 months once you've got the property sold, right? That you have to account for.
You're still
that's
paying carrying
complete.
Costs. You're still paying staging costs because you don't know if it's not closed until it's closed. I mean, there's things people don't consider, but nowhere near as expensive as doing the renovation properly out of the gate. People try to cut corners a lot, and they think this game is about cutting corners, and it's not.
It's not.
It's about doing it right.
Yeah.
You know?
100%.
One of the things we really look into when we're measuring the right property, right, we look into the absorption rate, days on market, how quickly is this property sitting in the market, or how long is it staying on the market, right? So, you know, time is our most valuable asset, whether you're renovating or you're on the market, you know. So we really look into that as well, because there's, you know, holding costs and what have you. And that's gonna hold you up from buying your next property, and then your next property, and it has a snowball effect, right? So if you can move quick, and you're doing the right things in the right sequences, and you're moving these properties, you're going to make more money because you're going to, you know, snowball into making more profit because you're moving this real estate.
On the resale side, I want to get into buy and hold versus fix and flip. But is there a different pricing strategy for investment properties versus retail? When you go to market, how do you price them typically, or is it all just your standard way you would list a house?
Yeah. I definitely, when I look at a property, whether it's online or visibly at the property, I use two sets of eyes, one for a buy and hold, one for a flip. I mean, clearly you can find a good buy and hold that does need work, but usually when you buy a buy and hold, you want to find something that you can literally, you can buy and then you can hold, and you can move it quick, right? So meaning it doesn't need a lot of work renovation wise. It might need an update on kitchen, it might need cleaning, it might need painting, carpet, or what have you. But you want to go through the same process. You want to look at the mechanicals, the windows. Is this going to be a good buy and hold? Or, you know, are my mechanicals old? Because you're holding it, right?
Let's say you finished the renovation. Let's say somebody's going to sell. They knew they were going to flip it, and they flipped it. I think just in the context of fix and flip, when you go to market, are you going to price a house that's worth $600 under for an investor and at $600 for if you're selling it for just an individual homeowner? Like, do you price it differently in the fix and flip based on that, or is your pricing strategy pretty consistent with going to market at the right price and, you know, just trying to get the property moved as quickly as possible?
It really depends what market you're in. I'm not necessarily trying to move the property as quick as possible. Sometimes I'm just trying to get the right number, right? So it really depends on what market we're in. Right now we're in a seller's market, right? Sellers typically have the upper hand, right? We're seeing a mix of a hybrid. Some buyers are winning, some sellers are winning at times, but, you know, knowing your market, so typically what we do is we list it a little bit under, right, to get that, like, kind of the auctioneer pricing, if you may, to get more buyers in the door. We need to get more offers. The more offers that we have 5-6 offers to pick from. Then we can figure out, you know, we can bid these offers up. We can bid them against each other. We have a handful of offers. Let's, you know, hey, look, if you want this property, you're going to have to bid it up, right? So traffic, we want traffic. We want enough feedback so we know what's going on. Because if we have one offer, it's a back and forth conversation of maybe not going to where we want to go. But if we have, you know, 3+ offers, we can disclose, we can inform, we have multiple offers. This is a bidding war. We didn't expect it to bid up quite this high.
But if you priced it too high or what it's worth in your mind, you might have not even gotten close.
Exactly. So that's another problem that a lot of realtors are facing in today's world. You know, they listen too much to the seller. They don't, you know, focus just on the data or emphasize that data to the seller. So, you know, we spend a lot of time in explaining to the seller. And if they don't get it, we explain it again and again and again. And if they don't get it, then it's maybe not the right candidate for the realtor and seller to get in that relationship. Right. So, I mean, I want to win with my client. And if I can't with my client and I can't get her through with them, it might not be the best scenario for him or I, her or I, to move forward.
And that's one of the key components, isn't it, from your perspective, is, you know, pricing it correctly out of the gate,
yeah,
right? Because the last thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the last thing that you want to have to do as the realtor or the realtor for the seller, right, is to have to take the price down. Right, reduce the price because it's been on the market for X amount of time, right? Once there's that first price reduction, as a buyer, you're like, okay, been on the market X.
Yeah.
Reduced once, God forbid twice. Like, how low are they willing to go? It's much harder from my perspective and in my opinion, from what I've seen. If you don't price it right the first time, it just gets much more challenging to move it anywhere close to where you want need to be as you go forward.
You hit the nail on the head. You got to price it right. Otherwise, you know, if you do a insignificant price improvements, changing the price $10,000 or $15,000, usually that doesn't move, you know, enough to get the traffic you need to move that property to get the right offer. So, you know, the pricing strategy really does matter. The three main factors that, you know, move properties are location, price, and condition. In that order, right? You can add a walk-in closet. You can, change the roof shingles, right? That's changing the condition. You can change the price, but you can never change the location, of course, unless it's a mobile home. but, you know, it's important that you come in with the right price so you can move that property so you can get your number.
No, I mean, that's great. That's great insight there. I guess once somebody gets to a point where they've sold their home, they obviously, or sold their project property, they can move on to the next one. They wait to the closing period, they cash out, they move on, and they keep going in most cases. In the case where somebody can't sell the property, I've come to understand there are some options.
Yeah.
Right? If it's taking too long, you can try to rent it. You can try to do a cash out refi. It's a little bit more difficult for particularly for some unaccredited investors, so to speak. But I guess from your guys' perspective, what happens if somebody doesn't sell a house? You mentioned earlier that you guys might assume it, auctioning it. Like, how far do you let the house go before you guys intervene and we're like, we're taking this house? Sorry.
You know, that's always that's the most challenging part. And, you know, we've been really fortunate because of how we approach things. We underwrite our borrower. It's about the borrower first. It's about the property second, right? Do we have a fundable borrower? Do they have a good property, right? But it's all about the borrower. And then by the way we approach underwriting the borrower and then looking at the property. And again, I had mentioned that we used to do eyes on, boots on, see the property before we agree to fund it. As we've grown, fortunately, we just don't have the time or the manpower to do that. So we use what's called a True Pick app, where the borrower goes in and they video everything that we would be looking at about the property if we were there ourselves, right? So it's as if we were there. The videos automatically upload. So we have a really good understanding, as good an understanding as you can have without being there yourself, of what that property looks like, right? So that now follows with, okay, is the scope of work valid? Is it enough? Have they accounted for everything that we would expect them and need them to account for? And you know, again, does that play to the ARV? Are they going to are they going to get the pricing that they need to? So the answer to your question is, if we've done all the necessary vetting of the borrower and the property to the best of our ability, it very rarely comes to that point, right? But it does. We're at less than 1% attrition in terms of homes that we've had to take back. And that's, you know, speaks directly to our underwriting approach of both borrower and property. But those are always really challenging conversations to have, because neither one of us wants that result.
Right, you make more money when people borrow money from you, right? When people do deals, you guys win.
Well, yeah, and they get to keep moving forward. And, you know, we hopefully have, by the way we've approached things, we've earned their business for the next deal by how we've taken care of them on the first deal. So it's always about good borrowers, good deals, rinse and repeat. That's the premise, right? But the premise doesn't always play out that way. So when it doesn't, we've had multiple conversations leading up to that point with the borrower where it's not a hammer, right? It's not a ghost jumping out of a closet and say, hey, we're taking it back, right? We've all seen this coming, and oftentimes the only time we do it is when there are no other answers, sure. Right?
But if you follow the steps, you follow the playbook, it's very difficult to mess it up too badly. I think is the thing that I've seen. Like, there's guardrails, so to speak, if you work with the right partners.
Completely agreed.
Yeah. I also found very valuable, you know, once you identify the property, fully get it inspected. We have lots of investors that will buy, you know, no inspections, and it really just depends on the market, but, you know, inspections are usually $500. Right, you know, depending on,
unless there's a well and a septic.
If it's well and a septic, it can rack up to easily, you know, $1,500 to $2,000 for all in. But
worth it.
But it's totally worth
always
it.
Always worth it.
I mean, you get 100 to 150 pages of report, and you get to analyze the property. Is there unforeseen termite damage? Is there?
And you can negotiate on it.
Yeah, you can negotiate. Is there mold damage? Doing a mold inspection. Is there issue with low water pressure? What's causing that? Is there a septic issue? I mean, guys, like, let's be real. Like, septic and well repairs, I mean, they could easily range from $30,000 to $50,000.
Foundation cracks. I mean, it's endless.
It's literally endless. Yeah. You got to really have good eyes. And when you're touring these properties, you're not going to go in the crawl space at times. You know, you're not going to go in the attic.
Good idea.
Yeah, right. Good idea.
Hard hat and a vest.
Yeah, but like, I mean, there's a lot to see, and like, we want to foresee all these different things. But you know, an inspector's out there with a magnifying glass. He's, you know, using his, you know, eyes and ears and getting a sense for what's going on. So when then we get a sense of when we're looking at the inspection report, we can use that as leverage. You know, to reanalyze the numbers on this property, and allows us to understand, well, we accounted for, you know, $85,000 of reno. Now we're at 120. What does that mean for negotiation during the inspection period, right? So we can use that leverage, that inspection report, to say, maybe this is a deal we move forward with. Are there deals that we've grabbed that we're like, no, we got to back out? And there are deals that we say, you know, we got to look at this price again, or renegotiate this price if we're going to proceed. And if the seller does play ball, maybe we won't proceed, just depending on how they respond.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, there's so many things that we can jump into. This has been so much fun, guys. Thank you for coming on and joining me on this adventure. I think I'm really excited to do this again. I think we've got something here. I hope you guys like listening to this at home. I think the next time we do this, we should talk about exit strategies. I think, you know, 1031 is really fascinating to me. Multifamily, fix and flip versus buy and hold. There's just so much to talk about in the world of real estate right now. But when you guys look at the market in 2025, let's just throw it out there. Do you guys have any predictions, or do you see any sea changes coming? And it's been a really rocky couple of years post-pandemic into the just astronomical rise of interest rates and housing shortages across the country. Like, are things getting better? Are they getting worse? What do you guys see?
I'm incredibly optimistic, right? And I never touch on politics. I never touch on religion. Those are intensely personal, and everyone's got an opinion, right?
A president and a rabbi walk into a bar now.
I'll listen to the joke. I won't tell the joke.
Fair.
I'm very bullish. I'm very optimistic. I think that yesterday, and the inauguration is, regardless again of your political affiliation or landscape, I think that only means good things for the economy in general, and that directly plays into our world. And I am incredibly optimistic and hopeful that 2025 and the 3 years that follow, that we're going to be in a really good space. And you know, I think, yeah, amen, brother. I think that that's the way you have to approach it. I mean, I'm a glass half full guy anyway, right? You play the hand that you're dealt. I'm pretty confident about the hand that we just got dealt.
Interest rates below 5?
I don't see that coming anytime soon.
How about you? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I definitely see some market improvements. I think the best way to predict the future is look at the past. You know, when President Trump was in office before, we saw, you know, a very, very thriving real estate market. I know there's been a lot of changes since then, inflation, it's gonna be hard to curb. And, you know, there has to be a stop to the, you know, the home prices increasing the way that we did see them in the past. But, you know, real estate typically follows a 4% bell curve year over year. I mean, there's some years where trends, you know, 7-8%, that's a little bit on the higher end. But I do think that, you know, we have a massive supply and demand issue, and I don't think that's going to change really anytime soon, because a lot of people are like holding on to their, you know, 2-4% rates, and we have credit card debts at an all-time high right now. So people that are, you know, have had those kids and have credit cards, you know, 30-40K, you know, swiped on, it's going to be hard for them to, you know, stomach a $4,000 mortgage payment, because that's the reality of where mortgage payments are right now. So I think you're going to still have a supply and demand issue, which is then going to keep values up. So, you know, if you can find the diamond in the rough, you know, really, really be patient and find that, say no 10 times before you say yes, to find that property. Just because you're getting excited about it, the numbers look okay, I'd maybe could reconsider waiting a little bit further. So I do think that the market's going to improve. No, I don't see rates hitting the 5s. I would say, you know, low 6s. You know, maybe if you do some buy downs, maybe a 5, but upper 5s potentially by the end of the year. But I think we're going to ride this one out. I think the spring market's really going to tell a lot how things are going to perform and things are going to go. So, you know, measure things out by quarter, and just, you know, follow everything. Follow the stocks, follow, you know, crypto, follow the real estate market. See how things are moving. See how the world is communicating. See how things are going. And I think that will help you make some bigger key decisions. Do I make this investment? And you have to feel confident taking that step. Whether you're buying one or you're buying 10, we're here to help.
That's great stuff, guys. Well, I'm Andrew Schuster.
Andrew Johns.
Dave Bond.
And this has been the Real Estate Investors Playbook. Wishing you guys an incredible 2025, full of health, wealth, and hopefully some liquidity. We will be back next month, and we'll cover some more topics, but please send us any questions you have in the meantime, and we'll see you next time.